Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
I'm Tiziana Deering. We're continuing our coronavirus coverage all afternoon, and in this first hour, we are focusing on the impacts of the coronavirus on children and families. How do we talk to our kids about it? And how about managing work and kids at home every day? We'll answer your questions. We'll get advice from mental health professionals and parent bloggers. So call 1-800-423-8255. With schools statewide closed starting today, we start with Brenda Caselius, superintendent of the Boston Public Schools. Superintendent Caselius, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Nice to be on with you.
Nice to have you. And the superintendent will take your call. So if you have a question for her, call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, Superintendent, statewide school closing today until April 6th, but Boston is going until April 27th. What factored into that decision?
So, you know, when we made the original decision, we factored in a lot of things in collaboration with our Boston Health Commission as well as the city offices and city services, and we just thought it was prudent for our city to be able to close until April 27th to give us that amount of time to see this very evolving situation. As you can tell by other states, it has been rapidly evolving and hour by hour, day by day, and we just thought that that's the time that's going to be needed.
Is it possible that schools could open sooner, Superintendent Caselius? And if so, with how much notice to parents and families?
Yeah, I'm told that if we actually get this flattening of the curve, I've heard it called, we could open up earlier. That's in the best case scenario. But right now, you know, April 27th is our target date.
This was such a huge move. What did it take to get prepared with so little time to do something like this?
Well, we had been getting prepared for a number of weeks. I think what was surprising was how quickly the decision had to come. And so last Wednesday, we had several things happen with the president giving the address, restricting travel, with the NBA closing their season, with us finding our first confirmed case in a school. And we just felt it was very prudent, as well as the mayor, to be able to protect all Bostonians, given the information that we had from the CDC and from our Boston Health Commission, to do so would be to close the schools swiftly and to protect our citizens.
This is an extra hour of Radio Boston, and we're speaking with Superintendent of Boston Public Schools, Brenda Caselius. If you have a question for the superintendent, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Superintendent, it's a really diverse school system, and we also know that the majority of the students rely on the school for meals. How are you accommodating that need during this time, and is it fairly straightforward, or is this a big part of the challenge of closing the Boston Public Schools?
Well, it's a little different in our delivery method, so we're very used to serving our students multiple times during the day, over 50,000 meals to our students. And so what it was a deployment issue for us, and so wanting to make sure that we had multiple sites close to home, because our children don't always go to school close to home. And so we had to make sure we were able to get the meals there, make sure we get enough meals. We're also going to be serving our charter school, our Medco students, and also the parochial students. And really, we won't turn any child away. And so that was a little bit different in terms of our volume of the expectation of students we would be serving. So that was different. But we have such an incredible staff. They were able to mobilize quickly, have it delivered, have it you know, safely prepared and ready for our children this morning. And I'm just so proud of our BPS staff.
As this unfolds, I think people in general are becoming increasingly aware of populations they might not have thought of before. So young people or students in the Boston Public Schools who are homeless, who are in shelter if they're not in school, who are in abusive home environments, who don't have a safe place to be. I recognize the Boston Public Schools can't do everything, but how are you thinking about those children and what they're missing when they don't have a school building to be in all day during the week?
Yeah, so that was our biggest concern, was not only the food, but the safety of our children as well, especially our students who are most vulnerable, that being our undocumented students, and making sure that they're safe and they know how to access services in a safe way, making sure that our students who are on respirators and have medical complexities, making sure that they have their assisted learning devices at home and that they have the care that they need at home. So we'll be calling each of those families to ensure that we come up with plans for them that are realistic, one that we can still try to help them with, as well as connecting them to other services that we can provide for the family. So those are really significant concerns. And then for students who are homeless, we've been working and coordinating with the city and their services around housing. I was happy to see that there was a 90-day suspension of evictions. I think that's critical for the stabilization of our families, especially as we have some of these restrictions for our children to be safe and stabilized in home.
One of the things that's been assumed by families and communities, I think, with these school closings is that there are ways for learning to continue to take place at home. I know the Boston Public Schools has been concerned about and invested in Chromebook or laptop distribution. How are you ensuring equitable distribution so that students who need to learn from home can have internet access, have the tools and resources they need, et cetera?
Yeah, so this is where that all hands on deck has really been able to help us out in Boston. We just have such a generous community, and the mayor has made this a significant priority of his, that learning does continue. Obviously, it will not be the same as being in the classroom with the teacher, but we do want to provide for that gap that we think could happen to fill that gap with supplemental materials. So what we've done is provided printed materials at home for parents. There are descriptions on our website. Teachers will be going online next week to connect with their students through their Google digital backpacks that they already have been doing. Each school has a little bit different plan, given different schools have autonomies and different plans already. So we want to make sure that every child has both printed materials available to them as well as Chromebooks when they come in. Some schools have given out their Chromebooks already, and those who do not yet have them have printed materials. And also we will have a way for parents to, they'll get both text and robocall to make an appointment to get issued their new Chromebook.
What about students with IEPs, special needs, students who are maybe receiving special or additional educational support in the classroom that's just not going to be available to them at home? I know in general you're worried about what would be the equivalent of summer learning loss. What about students who are more vulnerable in terms of their learning when they're not in the classroom environment?
Yeah, so this is my biggest concern with this extended hiatus here of formalized learning is our students with disabilities. We know that anytime children are away from these really significant supports, it can impact both their social-emotional well-being in terms of isolation from their peers. This is especially true for our students with autism. We want to make sure that we're able to work with our students who have dyslexia, make sure that they have the kind of learning supports with the literacy materials that they get. And we know that there is the risk that they may lose some of their gains, and we want to be sure as much as we possibly can that we are connecting with them. So our special ed teachers, as well as some of our professional special ed staff here at Central Office, are going to be trying to do weekly touch-ins with families to see that they have the services and the materials that they need to prevent as much loss as we possibly can.
So, you know, we are a social animal, and being in contact with each other, keeping an eye on each other, interacting and not feeling isolated is such an important part of mental well-being and social-emotional well-being. How are you thinking about that for both teachers and students, given how isolated people will be now and how this natural community is no longer available, at least for a time?
Yeah, it's really hard because, you know, we want to hug our children every single day, especially when we know that they're afraid or that they are hurt and they just need to have a hug. And so this 6 feet, you know, kind of social distancing is very challenging. And, you know, I've actually realized my own self how very difficult it is because I'm a hugger and, you know, I like to handshake people all the time. And so it's been very challenging, and I'm sure it's very, very stressful for children. So the more that parents can talk to students and children about this very honestly and in a real way, and then listen to them and let them express their feelings about it and honor their feelings no matter where they're at, you know, with whether they're angry about it, whether they don't understand it, or whether they think it's not a big deal. I think that it's important that we not correct the feelings that they have, let them feel those feelings, and then help them work through it and understand the crisis that we are going through.
WBUR spoke to kindergarten teacher Alana Ainsworth yesterday, the last day before schools closed, and she said she spent much of her day helping her class kind of understand what to expect. Here she is.
I've been talking with them a lot today about, like, okay, we're not going to see each other for a while, but it's not going to be that we're not here, and it's not like we're never going to see each other again. We're going to come back as a community again, but you're just going to be learning at home for a long time with your families.
Our next segment this hour is going to be with people helping teach families how to talk to their children about what's happening. As a superintendent, as an educator, what would you have parents tell their children about this school hiatus?
Well, I think the best thing that parents can do is try to still keep their children connected to their peers and to their friendship groups. That parents should stay connected with them and develop their relationships, do fun activities like games and cards and puzzles, you know, kind of the old school stuff. Limit the screen time that they have. Make sure that they find joyful times to go outside, walk around the block, play with the pets if you have a family pet. Have them do caregiving so that they feel value and that they're adding to the chores and being good contributors to the household management, so that it's not all on the parents. You know, so parents, I think a good thing to do is to give children activities and structures and routines throughout the day, and they'll find that their days flow very nicely. We are going to have computers to our students so that they can stay connected to their classmates and to their teachers. And so I think that it's really important to continue that sense of community so that when we do start up, whether that is earlier or April 27th or maybe even later, depending on this evolving situation, that when students do come back, that they're, you know, didn't miss a beat in terms of being able to be connected to their peers.
I do want to get a couple more questions in before we have to let you go. The first is, you know, will school employees get paid during this time? And we actually had a question come in through Twitter about a per diem sub and if and how they would be compensated. So who is being paid, if anybody, and how during this time?
So the mayor has committed to working with all of our labor unions around the pay piece, and I believe that he has committed to public employees being paid. And so, you know, that if you're a public employee, you will be paid. Now, I know that his team is working with all of our labor unions on that.
I know another really big question on parents' minds is what's going to happen with MCAS, which was due to start relatively soon.
Well, the mayor spoke to my heart the other day when he said we need to be worried about our children's food security and their safety and their learning outcomes first right now in this crisis rather than worrying about standardized testing. So I'm hoping that the state will push that off. Already with the state closed for 3 weeks, that interferes with, I believe, the state testing. And so they're going to have to for sure postpone it, if not eliminate it at all. I don't know how children could even think about taking MCAS tests now, given the stress level and those results being valid or reliable at this point.
And just to be clear for our listeners, that's a decision that you're awaiting from the state itself.
Exactly, both state and federal law. So the federal government would need to give relief to the state, but because Massachusetts has both state law and federal law, both bodies would have to approve that.
Superintendent, there's so much going on with the schools. Today is not the time to talk about the Department of the DESE report that came out last Friday, but I am hoping that you will come back in the future and talk with us about that. Is that something you'd be able to do?
Sure.
Great. And in the meantime, thank you for being with us today and for, you know, staying in touch with our listeners about how all of this is unfolding. This is Brenda Caselius, Superintendent of Boston Public Schools. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We are taking your questions on the impacts of the coronavirus on kids and families. A little later in the hour, we will speak about activities you can do with kids who are home from school. But first, how do we even talk to our kids about what's happening? How are you talking about it at home? Do you need help finding the right approach? Or what questions do you have about how much your kids should know or what's age appropriate to tell them at this point? Call with your questions. Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. And we have people on the line to help answer those questions and talk with you. The first is Dr. Jean Baresson, Executive Director of the Mass General Hospital Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds and a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Hello, Dr. Baresson. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Also on the line is Dr. Larry Berkowitz. He's a licensed psychologist in Massachusetts and the director and co-founder of Riverside Trauma Center. Welcome.
Thanks, Tiziana. Glad to be here.
And again, you can call with questions for our panel at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to start with this week. Dr. Baresson, what should parents say to children about why they're not at school right now?
Well, parents need to be honest. Most kids know that there's a pandemic. They know that there's a virus or an illness. But what we don't know is what they know. And many of the kids have heard lots of different things, sometimes misinformation. So before we tell them, we ask them what they've heard, because we want to know what they're thinking and what they're feeling. So I would ask them open-ended questions. What have you heard about the coronavirus? Where did you hear about it? What are your worries? Do you have any questions or concerns? Then once we find out what they actually know, then we can actually tell them that there is an illness that's being spread and we're all staying home because we want everyone to stay safe.
And Larry Berkowitz, how do we think about the age ranges of children at home and what kind of information they're prepared to handle depending on their age, their maturity, their ability to process, et cetera?
Right. Parents know their kids well.
I think we may have lost Larry Berkowitz for a moment there. So while we try to get him back, Dr. Baresson, is that something that you can pick up for us?
Sure. First of all, we have to be aware that all kids of all ages have three questions. You know, am I safe? Are you the people taking care of me safe? And how is this going to affect my daily life?
And so to be clear, you're saying no matter what age your child is, those are three questions that are going to be on their minds.
Absolutely. And those three questions are key. But the way we address preschoolers ages 3 to 6, school-age children, say 7 to 12, and teenagers and young adults, say 13, to 18 and beyond, is going to be very different. For the very young children, we want to minimize conversations about the problem. We want to keep the television and radio off because it's going to scare them. And they're going to react more to our own emotions than to actually what we tell them. School-age children, they want to know what the routines are. They want to know schedules. They're very concerned with how things are affected, in terms of their friends and their games and their hobbies and their activities. And we want to address them and say that there's a problem that we're all dealing with, and we're all going to stay home, and we're going to, keep our schedules and routines here. You'll do your schoolwork here, and we'll, play with each other here. Teenagers and young adults are much more able to understand the nuances of this problem and think complexly. They're often worried about how this is going to affect the here and now, but also their future. And for them, I think sitting in front of television or online and looking at information, finding out, how they're getting their information, discussing what they're going to be doing in terms of their hobbies, schools, college. A lot of teenagers are very worried about missing out on things, and for them, we have to have conversations with them to explain what's going on and brainstorm about how we can actually work together to deal with this challenging situation.
So I think we have Larry Berkowitz, licensed psychologist and co-founder of Riverside Trauma Center, back on the line with us. Larry, are you back with us?
Thanks. The connection seems a little iffy, but I am here.
Okay, we're going to hold you as long as we can. I want to ask first, if we have a caller, and I want to get that caller in a second, but I want to ask first if you have anything you want to add to what you just heard.
Unfortunately, I didn't hear a lot, but Dr. Baresson was absolutely talking about offering structure. We think about providing, at our place, we often talk about safety, predictability, and control, and that's our job, is try to help our kids feel safe. We talk with them. Doctors and scientists working on helping us all. They can stay safe by washing their hands and social distancing. The predictability, I mean, we were just hearing about, you know, helping establish schedules for them and control. They help establish the schedules. Can they make their own schedules? Can they help with planning family meetings to talk about what's going on?
So giving them a greater sense of control over what's happening during their day.
Absolutely.
All right, let's pick up a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What are your questions about the family conversations to have right now in the middle of this outbreak? Not just about school, but about the disease itself, health and well-being of family members, et cetera. Alex is on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts. Alex, what's your question?
My question is, I have five children that range in age from 17 to 3. So they obviously have very differing, you know, abilities to cope with what is going on with the coronavirus. And what is the dinner table conversation supposed to look like this around this, where we have older children understand the profound economic and health impacts of this, along with younger children who are just saying, you know, everyone's home. What does this mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. Dr. Bresson, let me just start by, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, you're right.
Great. I just want to be sure, as one with an unusual name, I'm very careful about those things. What is your thought for Alex?
Well, obviously, you know, the conversation is going to be different for preschoolers than it is for adolescents. So one thing, for when everybody's together, turn the TV and the computers and the radio off, because what is going to be acceptable to a school-age children or a child or an adolescent is certainly inappropriate for younger children. Number two, I would keep the conversation when everybody's together very simple. Safety precautions, as we've just heard, washing your hands together, doing things together, talking about being safe, trying to have family activities that everyone can engage in. Then I would separate the kids for different conversations by their age. I mean, adolescents require a different conversation than school age children. And I think, you know, when they're all in the room, keep it really simple and basic. And at the level of the youngest, younger children. And then I would try to separate them out so that you could address their specific needs based on their developmental levels.
So Alex's question really resonates in my head. I am the youngest of eight living children, and I remember that dinner table. Mm-hmm. And many of my brothers and sisters were significantly older. Teenagers do not cooperate about conversations. So if your older children are at that dinner table and you want that family time and they're going after it, I mean, how do you do the ixnay on the octay while the younger children are at the table? Larry, maybe you can help with that.
I'm sorry, I cut out there again. So the question is about how do you help manage the different ages in the conversation?
Yeah, if you're at the dinner table, if all the kids are together and you've got different kids at different ages who are ready for different kinds of engagement, clearly you try to keep them separated. But do you actually say in front of the younger children, we're not going to talk about this right now? Or is that a sort of a caution whistle to the little ones itself?
Yeah, great point, because kids are picking up on the emotional state of the parents.
I think we're just struggling with Larry Berkowitz's line there. So, Dr. Bresson, I'll let you pick right back up on it.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I would do. I would bring the adolescents aside outside of the dinner table, and I would say to them, you know, part of your kids need to feel that they're helping the cause. As Dr. Berkowitz was saying, they need to feel that they're in control, and they want to. And we want them to be supportive. I would say, you know, you can be a real helper to your younger brother and sister by keeping the conversation at their level. Let's not address more complicated issues at the dinner table and keep it quiet. If, you know, obviously they know, kids know that they're going to have to be pulled away from the table if they start getting into it. But teenagers will generally, for the most part, everybody knows this is a crisis. And if you help give the teenagers a mission, you know, you can help the family by doing the following things. It's a great thing to do. The other thing to do is, if it's getting out of control, I would basically say, wait a second, let's all wash our hands together singing Happy Birthday twice, because that's the way we're going to do it for the proper amount of time. Again, the way preschoolers and young school-age children would do it. Many of the teenagers will roll their eyes and leave the room.
fine. You know, if they're going to be uncooperative, then you're going to have to pull them aside. But, you know, in my experience, when there are major challenges and crises, whether it's hurricanes or this is unusual for us, a pandemic, most kids will rally and come to the aid of the whole family.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK on this extra call-in hour of Radio Boston, where we're talking about the impact on children and families of the coronavirus outbreak as we are experiencing it. We're going to give it one more shot with Larry Berkowitz, the licensed psychologist and co-founder of Riverside Trauma Center. I think we've tried a different line now. Do we have you?
Exactly. This is old school. It's just a regular phone now, yeah.
Well, I'm a big fan of old school phones. And it does raise this other question that I know some of our listeners have had and that I've been wondering about. Kids know when parents aren't being authentic.
Yeah.
What is the line between showing adult emotion, adult fear, concern, anxiety, versus not in the household, especially when parents may not always be able to contain it with the speed and the ferociousness of the information as it's coming in? Larry,
that's
maybe you can
point.
Start with that.
Yeah, we have to be managing our own reactions as best we can, because you're right, our kids pick up on it. They can read us very clearly and easily. So we want to be honest. We want to say, yeah, this makes me nervous too, and here's what I'm doing to try to help keep myself calm. But as parents, we need to be watching out for ourselves. We need to follow the same advice we want to give our kids. We want to have a careful diet of how much we're watching the news and just taking in a little bit at a time from trusted, reliable resources. We want to demonstrate and model for our kids that when we're upset or nervous, we talk to the people we care about, that we're staying on the phone with our friends and family, that we're doing some relaxation techniques or mindfulness or using an app to help us stay calm. We want to be demonstrating, being transparent, that we're trying to manage things too, but that we feel like we have control over it.
And another question that raises is questions of privacy. Not everyone lives in a home where there can be a lot of distance and space for private conversations, for sort of, you know, working through your emotions where your kids can't see. So in very tight, small spaces or in, you know, households where people are really quite crowded together, how does one create space and time for each person to emotionally process across the age ranges what's happening in our lives right now? Dr. Beresin.
Well, it's a really good point. I mean, in crowded spaces, we have to kind of all you know, do things that don't negatively affect others. I would have a discussion with all the kids saying, you know, we all need to stay calm. Let's all talk about what keeps you calm, what stresses you out, what makes you calm. And then go around the room and have people talk about them. Some kids will say, well, I like to draw. Well, I like to play games. I like to, you know, play a board game or a video game or watch a movie, or I like to listen to music. And then we could, you know, as a family, have a structure, have a means of going about it so that it doesn't interfere with other people, and that we could all either do things on our own if they're quiet, like reading or journaling or watching a movie with headphones on or listening to music, or we could do things together. I think the more we have discussions as a family about how we're going to do things that's acceptable to all, and again, you know, as I say to my own kids and to kids, or I did in the past, now my grandchildren and my patients, you know, families are not a democracy. I mean, parents need to take the lead, and they need to be in control, not in an authoritarian way, but in an authoritative way, saying, this is how I think we should do this, let's do it, and then have a means to do it in a way in which everybody kind of gets to win in their own way.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. What's worked in your household? How have you talked to your children or to each other about what's happening with this coronavirus outbreak? You know, another question that comes up is, how transparent should adults be with kids about the virus itself, how it works, what the symptoms are, who is at risk in the extended family, why you may not be going to visit the grandparents, et cetera? What level of transparency there is appropriate? And again, does that vary by age group? Larry, maybe you can start with that.
Sure. I think we have to be transparent, give some information, and as you point out, to think about the age group. We give less information, obviously, for our younger kids, and our adolescents can understand, you know, the high school age kids can understand more. and can be pulled into being helpful and allies with us around some of that. So you know, I think it's also important to not only give the information about what the virus does, but that to give as much accurate information as we can. So, for example, right now, the best information we have at this point of time is that 98% maybe of people who get this virus, for many of them, it's going to be very mild and not impact them much at all. For most people, you know, 98% of people, as best we know, or 97, 99, depending on the research you're looking at, most people get better. And that's an important part of the message, too. We have to balance. That's one of the ways of managing our anxiety and our reactions, is to understand that there's another side of it, too.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, another thing that has come up is adolescent anxiety. We are in a time where we know in many of our school districts and many of our families, we're seeing heightened level of adolescent anxiety, the lack of structure of not being in school, the awareness in your adolescent years of what's happening and how awful this might feel in the world can dial that up. So how do parents find mental health supports for their children? Especially, we know it is hard to get mental health support for adolescent anxiety. So what can we do there? Dr. Bresson.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, teenagers have their own set of stresses. I mean, they miss hanging out with their friends. They miss. So some are worried about you know, this is prime time for college applications. They're worried about that. They're worried about their grades. They're worried about for those that are not going to college or that are working to help support the family. They're worried about work. So it's normal for them to deal with this. And what's really important is to have them talk with you as a parent about it. Another thing is, just as parents need their own supports, I think, you know, teenagers need their own supports. And this is one place, you know, oftentimes we say digital media is, you know, for better or worse, oftentimes for worse. But this is one place where we can actually harness the value of online and digital media. I don't see anything wrong with having Skype, FaceTime, or other kinds of group calls between teenagers to keep them in touch with each other, to be in touch with community leaders, coaches, and other important people in their lives. They need to stay connected. I mean, two of the most important things that build resilience are engagement with others, and they need that, and awareness of their own feelings and attitudes and their beliefs and their reactions. So to help them express themselves, particularly with others, is very important. So that's an important thing. The other thing that Larry mentioned about adults is true for teenagers as well. There are resources online about self-care for teenagers. Yeah. So, for example, the Clay Center, we have three videos, one for middle school kids, one for high school kids, and one for college-age kids on self-care. And they're short videos. They're 6 minutes long. They're easily watched. We have an activity kit to build resilience that's based on those videos that can be used at home or can be used in school. And so tools like that can be very helpful if the teenagers want to use them.
And Larry Berkowitz, last word to you. What would your main message to families be at this point?
It's probably reiterating some of the things we've said, establishing safety, predictability, and control, and really sticking with that. Going with the times, acknowledging the times are difficult, being flexible, but really trying to build in as much structure as we can for our kids, and monitoring our own reactions. I think that's going to go a long way to helping our children.
Larry Berkowitz is a licensed psychologist in Massachusetts and the director and co-founder of the Riverside Trauma Center. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Jean Bresson is executive director of the Mass General Hospital Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds and a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All this hour, we are focused on the impacts of the coronavirus on children and families. We just took your calls with two mental health experts about how best to talk to children about the coronavirus and the ongoing outbreak. Now, what about keeping them and you entertained while stuck at home? What are you doing to keep your family from going stir crazy? Do you need suggestions for what to do? Do you have suggestions for what to do? Is there something that's working in your household? that you'd like to share with others, you can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. And joining us now to make some suggestions and help take your questions and calls is Quiana Agbai. She runs the Instagram Harlem Lovebirds in New England. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Cindy Reitmeyer, who runs the website Boston Tech Mom and is a STEM consultant for students and families. Welcome, Cindy.
Thank you for having me.
And Kiana, I'm sorry that I went with Quiana. We have a colleague here with that name, and I just went right to it. Sorry about that, Kiana.
Thank you.
All right. So if you two don't mind, we have a caller who came in at the end of the last segment, and I'd like to go right to her now. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. And we have Nina on the line from Brookline. Nina, go ahead.
Hi. Hi. So I'm here at home, working from home. I have two kids, a 6 and a 12-year-old, and the 6-year-old is happy as can be to be out of school, but our 12-year-old just doesn't want to do anything. I started day one with this huge list of all kinds of fantastic activities for all ages, and she's just mad that she can't hang out with her friends, and she doesn't want to do anything. So I was wondering, I mean, I don't know if that's just her way of feeling anxiety or whether there's anything I can do to get my 12-year-old engaged.
That is a great question, Nina. Cindy, I think you have older children. Maybe you can give an assist to Nina on this one for this intransigent tween that she has.
Yes, I have a teenager at home, too. So I think right now it is tough because the teenagers and the tweens tend to be very involved and active in school right now. And all those activities have come to a screeching halt. So I know with my own daughter, I'm giving her a little bit of time just to sort of, you know, ease into this. And the last few days, she's been walking the neighbor's dog and going on walks, and she does like to read. But what I did with her is I said she's been noodling for a while on a creative do-it-yourself project she wants to work on that has a little bit of a business angle. So just yesterday, I said, why don't you start to really think about that and let me help you get that started and maybe build that into working on that each day. So perhaps talk with your daughter about her interests and maybe a project she'd like to work on and, you know, take it from that perspective.
And so, Kiana, you have younger kids. Both your kids are under 10. I think this is the first day off of school for you. Is that right?
Yes, it is. They're in Boston Public School System. I have a kindergartner and a fourth grader.
So how did you prepare for today? And are you one of those moms who had like the color-coded schedule? Or did you kind of wake up this morning and say, how's this going to work?
Yeah, well, for us, my fourth grader doesn't get all of her information until tomorrow, actually. And that's when we'll be making use of Google Classroom. So we're going to kind of take the direction from Boston Public Schools on that. But I did see the color-coded chart, and that was great and all. That's been viral. But what I really found helpful, it's kind of what Cindy's saying, is kind of giving the kids, even though mine are 5 and 9, giving them autonomy in the matter. And I've learned that, in general, kids really like to know what the plan is. So I've sat down with them before knowing that today they were going to start to be home with us for the next 6 weeks. Over the weekend, we talked about what was about to happen. We had a family meeting to kind of decide what are some of the types of things that we'd want to do as a family. There's some things we've been putting off that aren't academic that we kind of want to do together. So it gives us an excuse to put those things in place. But for us, rather than make a mandated hour by hour schedule, we're kind of going with the look and feel of each day and, you know, making sure that we get some time outside. We kicked off with a walk yesterday, and today we were greeted with a little bit of snow. So we opted for some YouTube yoga instead.
All right. So we are talking about how to spend the time at home for families and kids. To call in, make your suggestions or ask your questions, it's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Anne is on the line from Fenway. Anne, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a full-time artist in Fenway Studios, and one of the assignments I gave to my students, even graduate students at the architecture school at Harvard, is an object notebook. So each kid would have a sketchbook, a notebook, and every day they have to do a drawing in it. And the drawing can be in multiple media. It can be in crayon and pencil, in watercolor. It can be a collage. But it should be just one object, like a teacup that you turn in many, many different directions. Because the challenge is to see how long you can stay with the object and how many different approaches you can have to it.
That's so conducive. That sounds so conducive to these kind of longer time periods at home. And Kiana, I am going to come back to you because I know arts and crafts are a key thing in your house. What's your reaction to Anne's suggestion?
I really love that. And what I've been seeing so far is a lot of artists and designers and creators, musicians, coming on and using technology to give mini lessons. So my kids have really got on board with that. They're not the type of kids who will sit down with all their supplies and get to work, but if it's guided and directed and they're following a short little 20-minute session, like Mo Willems is doing lunch doodles daily at 1 o'clock. So when those go live, my kids like to join in.
Is that on YouTube? Yes,
it's on YouTube. So we just subscribe to a few artists, and then you can set a reminder so it'll pop up on my device and say, hey, they're going live. So we've been able to do that with a few different artists and performers. And so far, the kids like those art breaks.
Cindy, what's the STEM equivalent of what Anne, the artist, was recommending with these object studies in a journal over a period of several days?
Sure. I think one suggestion I have is, this is a great opportunity if you want to dabble and try to learn to code. This is your time. So, you know, coding is a popular activity today for kids, even as young as elementary school, all the way through high school. And what I'd recommend is you can go on Hour of Code. It's a website, and they have free 1-hour coding tutorials and activities for all ages, interests, and skill levels. So it's a great way to get an introduction to computer science. Some of your kids may have already done it in their schools. But you go on the site, you're going to see hundreds of activities. There's themes for everyone, from Minecraft to Star Wars to Harry Potter. And what I recommend is for young kids.
So I think we may.
The activity with
there
them.
She is. We lost you for just a second. So pick back up,
sorry.
Cindy, where you said young kids.
Oh, yeah. So my recommendation is for young kids and those who haven't done any type of coding in the past as a parent or a caregiver. Sit down and do the activity with them just to give them some guidance.
And what if the parent's saying, I don't know the first thing about that either?
Yeah, most of the introductory programs start with a program language called Scratch, and it's a block-based visual programming language.
It's very user-friendly.
It's pretty easy to use. It's very user-friendly. And this is what I've done with my daughter, and I don't have a background in coding. And the great thing is you as the parent will get an introduction to coding as well. So similar to what you're just talking about, you could pick one of these activities every day, every other day, because there's so many different themes out there, and give your kids an introduction to coding.
Let's pick up a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Cassara's on the line from Watertown. Please go ahead.
Hi, yes. I am a licensed psychologist working with children, adolescents, and adults in Watertown. Many of the children and adolescents I work with have developmental disabilities and delays. And some of the issues that parents are facing with schools being closed is that ABA services and one-to-ones that these kids have depended on every day are no longer in place. And I think kind of what would be important to include in this conversation is the use of telehealth. I've been working with parents via video to help them create structures for their day with their children, in consideration of their developmental needs, but also parent support as well.
Thanks for that, Cassara. And I'm going to come back to both Cindy and Kiana on this and ask you, in the resources that you've begun to gather for your own family strategies, for your blogs, have you come across resources that would be particularly helpful for families who have kids with developmental disabilities, intellectual developmental disabilities, physical disabilities, who might need a different kind of set of supports at home while we're in this great period of interruption? Cindy, why don't I start with you, or whoever that was? Go right in.
Oh, this is Kiana. I haven't seen anything in the resources that I'm coming across being as inclusive. What I am seeing, though, is the communication coming through from Boston Public Schools acknowledging that need is there and being willing to step up in that point about telehealth. So I'm seeing that communication come down generally with what's happening as far as knowing that that there is a need that needs to be filled. So I appreciate that caller bringing that up.
And we are seeing in general more discussions about telehealth and other forms of providing people mental and physical health care while sort of essentially sheltering in place or self-quarantining in their homes. So that's something we'll continue to watch and cover on WBUR as well. Let's take another call. Ellen is on the line from Brookline. Ellen, please go ahead.
Yes. I was going to say that for simple activities for kids, I learned this in Girl Scout camp. What you do is you take a like an Idaho potato, cut it in half, and then you could take a jackknife, a pencil, whatever, and draw a design.
On a potato?
On the potato, inside of the potato.
Okay.
And what you're doing is like take, for example, St. Patrick's Day. If you do a shamrock, so you do a shamrock, and then you'd cut it out so that the shamrock would be look like bar relief. You know what I'm saying?
I think I do. And then
and then you take whatever tempera paint you want or whatever, dip the potato
in
it.
Like a stamp.
And you put it, like a stamp. You're making your own stamp. And you have a big sheet of paper, and you just go around. You can either do it all lined up. You can do it in, like, make wrapping paper, or you can just do a whole montage of stuff and make one giant picture or something.
Ellen, I'm going to take it back from you from there. I have to admit, I am now dying to go home and try this with a potato. So, Kiana and Cindy, what are your sort of potato equivalents? Like, the go-to that is the most fun, most unexpected, most simple, low-tech, low-cost stuff in your areas of interest that you can do with kids? Cindy, why don't you go first?
Sure. Well, today online, you have access to so many great science experiments. So I was going to tell parents to visit a site called sciencesparks.com because they have a ton of free science experiments. And often you can do these with materials that you have around your house. And what I love about that site is you get an explanation of why the science works, how it works. You get instructions, list of materials, video, and pictures. So that's a great place to start. An activity I love is making circuits using Play-Doh. We might not all know, but Play-Doh is conductive. So if you
I
do get little LEDs,
that.
Yes, I do this at one of the STEM fairs in our elementary school. But if you use Play-Doh and some little LED light ups and a battery, you can teach kids very simple circuitry. And it's hands-on, which I'm a huge fan of, and just simple ways to understand science and electronics. But
excellent.
I would check out.
I'm sorry, we've only got about 20 seconds left. So, Kiana, I want to give you a chance here, too. Go ahead.
Yes, my go-to involves food. So during this time, we have to eat something, and limited deliveries and access to food, it causes us to get creative. So it's been really fun to get our kids involved in the pantries and the deep freezer and try to figure out how we can get creative in the kitchen and get them involved cooking with us.
Okay, and that is Kiana Agbai. She runs the Instagram Harlem Lovebirds in New England. The handle is Harlem Lovebirds. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Cindy Reitmeier, who runs the website Boston Tech Mom and is a STEM consultant for students and families. Thank you, too.
You're welcome.
We continue our coronavirus coverage today, including taking your calls with experts later in the hour. Governor Charlie Baker reiterated today that he is not planning to order residents to shelter in place, but that the state is taking the virus very seriously.
The reason we're taking this so seriously is because of it is incredibly contagious. There will certainly be more cases of COVID-19 here in Massachusetts, but we also know that if we take decisive steps now and everyone plays their part by following the best medical guidance, we can slow down the spread.
In Washington, the Trump administration is working with Senate Republicans on an $850 billion economic stimulus package, including a payroll tax cut and some $50 billion for the country's airlines. Joining us now on the line from Washington is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Senator, welcome back. It's good to have you.
No, thank you.
So let us start with this proposal out of the Trump administration. It includes sending checks directly to almost every American, deferring $300 billion in tax payments on April 15th. These ideas, the others, the airline support, et cetera, do you think they'll help keep the American economy afloat in the midst of this pandemic?
Well, again, we haven't seen the package yet. And so, you know, we'll be examining it in the course of today and for however long it takes in order to determine whether or not they're covering all of the people in our society that they should be covering as part of this emergency. We know that they will want to obviously take care of the airlines, but one of the questions we're going to have is what are they going to be doing for sick leave for everyone, not just the small number that have been covered so far? What are they going to do for tipped workers? What are they going to do for home care workers? What are they going to do for contractors? What are we going to do to prevent people from being evicted? What are they going to do to make sure people's utility bills that may go unpaid don't lead to their electricity or natural gas being shut off?
So let's pick up on that for a second, Senator, because one of the things we heard from the administration today is that they are now talking about sending money directly to almost every American. Your challenger, Representative Joe Kennedy, had put forward a proposal of payments to Americans. How do you feel about this idea of some sort of cash payment versus a payroll deduction to individuals in the United States?
Well, a cash payment is something that people can spend right now, and that's what I've been calling for, so that we can make sure that we get money into the hands of people immediately, so that they survive, pay the bills that they have now, buy the groceries they have to buy right now. So that's what we've been calling for, and we keep telling the president that you know, he should take an approach which puts cash in the hands of Americans, and maybe today he's changed his mind and he's going to do that. That's why looking at this proposal is going to be so important.
You know, in the last several days, you've called for a wartime ramp up on the response to the coronavirus pandemic, or a moonshot. What does that mean specifically? What would that look like?
Well, what it means is that, for example, we know from the president's own Department of Health and Human Services that we need 3.5 billion pieces of protective equipment, masks, gowns, ventilators, gloves. And according to the White House, they only have 12 million pieces in our strategic stockpile. So there's a big gap between 12 million and 3.5 billion pieces of protective equipment, which we're going to need.
So, how will we get from A to B there?
So the Defense Production Act allows the president to say to the private sector that we want their full involvement in the manufacture of all of this equipment, which we are going to need, and that it is something that will require companies to prioritize and accept government contracts for materials. For instance, we could contract with companies to produce medical supplies and ensure they immediately address our requests for production. We can provide them with loans or ensure that they know that there are going to be direct purchases by the government.
So to be clear, Senator, just as in wartime we might motivate companies to change their focus to, say, munitions or heavy equipment, you're saying that the president could use the Defense Production Act to stimulate businesses in the United States to turn their focus to manufacturing supplies, testing kits, et cetera, to ramp up the nation's response?
That's right. Yeah, under the Defense Production Act, we could use the federal government to create incentives to expand domestic capacity. We can provide economic incentives like loans, direct purchases, purchase commitments for respirator masks or other personal protective equipment. We can give cash now to companies to ramp up production, and companies don't have to worry if anyone will buy their equipment later if it goes unused. And again, right now, we only have 12 million respirator masks in the strategic national stockpile. We have doctors and nurses who are continually right now reusing their masks, reusing their equipment. And that's just something that is not ultimately healthy in terms of our ability to respond. So when you need 3.5 billion items, then I think it's absolutely critical that we invoke the Defense Production Act so that we can achieve that goal.
Let's shift gears to another critical question. You heard us say that at the top, that Governor Charlie Baker reiterated today that he's not planning to order residents to shelter in place. We've just heard that Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York City is absolutely considering a shelter in place. Do you want to see a shelter in place, and would that be regional, statewide, national? What's your thought on that?
Well, to be honest with you, my feeling is that the president should issue a set of guidance for the entire country using the experts from CDC and National Institutes of Health and our commissioned corps of professional nurses and doctors down in Washington. But you know, he's obviously not doing that. So it just leaves it up to each individual state to make a decision based upon the guidance they're getting from the public health officials in our own state. So,
do you believe Governor Baker is making the right decision now by reiterating that there will not be a shelter in place here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Well, I'm assuming that he's basing it upon the recommendation of our state public health officials.
So let's talk about Congress for a minute. We are not only in a health crisis, we are very clearly, especially based on what the markets have done in the last several days, plus closings of restaurants, lots of layoffs of hourly workers, et cetera, we're in an economic crisis. What should Congress be doing right now, and what's the balance of attention towards the public health issues and the economic issues that's right for Congress?
Well, again, Congress is we're the legislative emergency response team. If we're going to get the help to every single family, if we're going to get the help to every single business, to every single medical institution, every single first responder, we have to do our job. We should not leave here until we have a plan that we are funding and sending out to every state, every medical institution in our country. So that has to be the highest priority for our country, and we have to come together as a country. We have to put aside partisan differences, and we have to make sure that it's not ideology, but rather practicality that guides all of our decisions.
And Senator Markey, is this a moment that can do that? Are you seeing signs that in this shared crisis, there's possibility to bridge the divides in Congress, in the Senate, in the House, across party lines?
Well, we did so on the $8.2 billion piece of legislation that sent $12 million to the state of Massachusetts in the last couple of weeks.
To support medical response?
Yes, for coronavirus. And on this second bill that has been held up for the last 4 or 5 days, I think that it might have got caught up a little bit in politics, but Mitch McConnell is saying that we will have a vote on that, and that will be a good sign. But this larger package, however, that we're now talking about, we have to ensure that as we take care of the big guys in our economy, that we take care of all the little guys, too. We take care of small businesses, that we take care of individuals who are going to be just pummeled by this recession, which the president has already predicted will unfold. It's always ordinary families, poorer families that get impacted, and we have to make sure they're fully protected in this legislation, and we lay out a plan to make sure they get the revenue, they get the health care coverage, which they're going to need in order for their families to stay afloat.
And to that end, and finally, what is your message to our listeners, the people of Massachusetts? They're at home, self-isolating, maybe scared and stressed. What's your message?
My message is just to follow all the public health guidance, wash your hands, social distance, make sure you're sanitizing as much as you can, but continue to, you know, press for our government to act and act boldly, act big, to respond to something which is unprecedented. And so they can still remain politically active, you know, because of social media demanding that the government respond to deal with all of the problems that are going to be created. Trump waited a couple of months too long in order to begin to deal with this, so we're late. We just have to make sure that that we pass something and that they know that the checks will be delivered to families across our country in soon, very soon.
I'm sorry, I'm
going
to have to interrupt you there, Senator Markey. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, glad. Yeah, thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
We are continuing to take your calls on the coronavirus this week.
What do you want to know? Call with your questions. What are you wondering about? What's weighing on your mind today that maybe wasn't even a question you had yesterday? Join us on the line to help answer your questions is Dr. Natasha Hochberg, Associate Professor of Medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. She's also an infectious disease physician at the Boston Medical Center. Welcome back again, Dr. Hochberg.
Hi, happy to be with you.
Also on the line is WBUR's Common Health Editor, Carrie Goldberg. Carrie, good to talk to you again.
Thanks. You too, Tiziana.
So, Carrie, before we start taking calls, can you just give us the latest on how the Commonwealth is addressing the outbreak?
Yes. Well, as you heard, we are not getting a shelter-in-place order, at least not at this point. There's money flowing to the local boards of health. And then I have a couple, three news items that we haven't really covered yet on our air. One is this very interesting development that Kearney Hospital in Dorchester, actually, we've covered that a little bit, but Kearney Hospital is going to be transformed into a sort of a dedicated coronavirus care center by its parent company, Steward Healthcare, which is a for-profit healthcare company. Kearney has been, you know, kind of troubled over the years, but I think it's an interesting development because I suspect that we'll be seeing more of this, which is dedicated facilities or sections of hospitals that will be for coronavirus.
So, Carrie, are you saying the hospital's just going to be for coronavirus treatment?
That is what Steward Healthcare says. It will be a dedicated care center for treating patients who test positive for COVID-19.
All right.
So yes, it wasn't a particularly viable hospital before, and now it will be devoted specifically to coronavirus care is what Steward is saying.
Okay.
Second, there's some DNA news that's hot off the presses, which is that the Broad Institute, which I'm sure you know is this genetics powerhouse in Cambridge affiliated with Harvard and MIT, they have one of the biggest genetic sequencing facilities in the world. They are being pulled in by the state to help with testing. So they have this like high throughput testing capability, and their scientists have been working around the clock to adapt what they've got to be able to do coronavirus testing. And now both the state and the Broad are saying they are going to be helping with testing. They should be able by early next week to process more than 1,000 tests a day. So that will really bring us up to the capacity that we've been needing to be able to really test patients in Massachusetts.
All right, terrific. And Carrie, just very briefly, how does that coincide with what's happening nationally?
Well, I mean, nationally, it's just a great big struggle to ramp up testing to the levels that we need, right? To be able to diagnose patients, to be able to get a better handle on where the virus is spreading. And so what I like about it is it's kind of bringing our biomedical Boston brains to bear to attack what is a very national problem.
And Dr. Hochberg, being one of our biomedical Boston brains, let me first ask you, what's it like at the hospital right now?
Well, it's a good question. So obviously, you know, we're trying to get prepared as best we can. And I'd say that's going on across the state. Is the infrastructure that we need to take care of patients effectively. So just a lot of people are dedicating a lot of time, both sort of taking care of patients at this point, but also just making sure the infrastructure is there to ramp up.
And do you have that infrastructure? We just heard Senator Ed Markey at the top of the hour about, you know, hospitals and healthcare workers having to reuse equipment, massive shortages. We're hearing reports of hospitals like Cambridge Health Alliance and the Brigham and Women asking for equipment like face masks, face shields. Is BMC experiencing anything similar to that?
So we're working through our numbers in terms of what we have, and we're sort of adjusting policies as we need to. And so it's a situation that's constantly evolving, and we're looking for guidance also from sort of federal authorities on what is safe to do. You know, can we reuse any of the equipment? And if so, what can be reused? And how, but we're, you know, I would say it's just sort of a developing situation at this point while we all figure out what's the best thing to do to keep ourselves safe and our patients taken care of.
I guess I have to ask you, Dr. Hochberg, are you worried?
So I think that, you know, as you said, it's Boston. We've got a lot of Boston brains that are working on it. So, you know, I'm really glad because of that. I would say that this has been an effort by the Health Department. It's been an amazing effort. Hospitals, not only physicians and others, but the sort of administration to really grapple with
So, you know, so Dr. Huckburn,
it's not an easy situation.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Yeah. You're cutting out a bunch, and I do want our listeners to understand that as part of the coronavirus response, we are exclusively talking to people over lines. We don't have anyone in the studio anymore. So forgive us if we're having a little bit of cut in and out of lines, because we're redoing how we do radio right now, too. Let's use this opportunity to grab a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Alex is on the line from Walpole. Alex, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, my hands get quite dry in the wintertime, and especially if I'm washing a lot like I've been doing, as I'm told. Anyway, they get cracked. Microfissures, they actually start to bleed.
Yeah.
So I'm concerned about, I mean, if transmission is fraught when it comes to touching your face, I'm wondering what kind of element this introduces to possible contamination.
It's a great question. I'm looking at the cracks in the backs of my own hands right now, Alex. So, Dr. Huckburn, this faithful hand washing that's producing these fissures in the backs of hands, does that actually increase concerns about virus transmission? So I think we lost her. Carrie, have we heard any guidance from the Department of Public Health or other offices about this concern? I've heard this repeatedly. Wait a minute, I'm washing my hands, but they're actually getting bad. Is that putting me at greater risk?
Right. I have not heard any guidance about that. I have a ridiculously practical suggestion that I'm sure you've thought of, Alex, which is to use moisturizing soap as you do it and other emollients. But otherwise, no. We know, I mean, what experts are saying is that the main method of transmission is through droplets that come from the upper respiratory system. So if you're worried about, like, virus getting into your blood through your hands, I have not heard anything about that.
Okay, that's comforting. And Alex, hopefully that's comforting to you too. We do have Dr. Huckburn back on the line on a cell phone. Let's just check that out. Dr. Huckburn, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Great.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. So let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Joe on the line from Northampton. Joe, go ahead.
Yes, my question is that we have a couple of summer cottages that we do a summer rental for on Cape Cod. And I know it's some time off, but we're going to begin our rentals in the middle of May this year. And just wondering what the outlook on that will be, whether we're going to be able to go forward or whether we're going to have to cancel our season.
Should you do it or not, in other words?
Exactly.
What do you think, Dr. Huckburn?
I think nobody has a crystal ball, unfortunately. We'd all like to anticipate exactly what's going to happen. You know, I think that we're increasingly knowing we need to sort of put in social isolation measures for a while to come. And my hope is that things are ready for you to go by the end of May. And but I can't guarantee that. That would be my hope for you. So I think it's impossible to give you a definitive answer.
And Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg, what are we hearing about the efficacy of cleaning services, of you know, deep cleaning of houses? One could imagine someone saying, okay, well, there's only going to be three of us. We'll shelter in place in that house if we rent it. But I'm sure part of the concern is, can that house then be cleaned and safe after one family leaves? Again, any guidance on that yet or looking forward on those questions?
Well, so I'm so glad you raised that, Tiziana. I mean, we have been being told that, you know, cleaning with bleach and other effective cleaning agents should, in fact, kill the virus. And there was a paper that came out just today in the New England Journal of Medicine that was talking about this question of to what extent the virus can be transmitted on surfaces and also in the air. And it concluded that that this new coronavirus doesn't seem to linger very much in the air and it doesn't linger on surfaces for any longer than SARS did back in the early 2000s. So the thinking is that there must be a different reason why it's so infectious. Maybe it's because people without symptoms are transmitting it quite a bit, or maybe because there's a lot of virus in the upper respiratory system, in the nose and the throat. And I really wanted to ask Dr. Huckburn about this. Like, what is it looking like in terms of this virus and how it gets transmitted?
So I think we're pretty clear about the transmission. It's everything that you sort of said so far in terms of droplet transmission and just to reiterate to everybody that, you know, the important thing is that because droplets are transmitted about 6 feet away, that that's why we're really coming up with those measures of sort of maintaining your distance from other people so that you're not getting coughed on. But I think your point about these sort of virus sort of resting on surfaces is a good one. The data that you sort of talked about show that it can be on surfaces. So it can last on surfaces, cardboard for about a day, plastics up to 72 hours. So it can rest on these surfaces, and that's why we're emphasizing the importance of cleaning off those surfaces. So if you can imagine that every surface is potentially covered with this sort of virus, you want to make sure that you're cleaning it before you're touching it and therefore potentially touching your mouth or face and becoming infected.
Let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Bill on the line from Watertown. Bill, what's your question?
So I've got a question related to transmission in warmer weather.
Go ahead.
And I've read a lot of things that say, well, we'll have to see. But right now we've got cases in Singapore. We've got cases in Spain. And those regions are already warm. I'm wondering whether there's enough data to determine whether the virus is less transmittable in warmer weather with the data that's already out there in regions that are warm now.
Terrific. And I imagine both of you could have perspective on this. Why don't we start with Dr. Hochberg?
Sure. So it's a great point. What we know is in general that humidity affects the transmission of viruses, particularly influenza that causes the flu. And so we hoped that in sort of, warmer weather, when it's more humid, there's not going to be as much transmission. But you're exactly right. We're seeing cases in warmer countries right now, like Singapore. And so, it's possible that the humidity and the temperature are not going to have as much of an effect as we would hope.
And Carrie, is there anything additional that you've seen in your reporting or in the literature to help answer that question?
Well, it's kind of just a damned if you do, damned if you don't. It would be nice if this virus were like the flu and it really receded over the summer. On the other hand, you know, a lot of people are talking about the 1918 flu and how it came roaring back in the fall. So I don't know which is worse.
Okay. We've got lots of calls, so let's just keep going. Thanks for that, Carrie. 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. David's on the line from Reading. David, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a physician on the north side of Boston. I do primarily inpatient work. And my question is about the testing. So my understanding is the CDC guidelines currently suggest specific criteria for testing COVID. And what I'm seeing in a lot of the patients that are admitted on our services are patients who are admitted for things other than what we would traditionally think would be a viral illness and subsequently are getting testing for COVID. What that then results in is a significant depletion of resources, masks, PPEs, gowns, et cetera. And I'm wondering if you had any thoughts about, to the extent possible, are we actually over-testing on patients,
That's a really interesting question.
Then depleting these very valuable resources?
Thanks for that, David. Dr. Hochberg.
Yeah, I think it is a really important question. I think we're grappling with similar things of exactly who do you test. The problem is it's going to be a balance between wanting to make sure if somebody's hospitalized and they have compatible symptoms that we're not missing them, because then it's potential risk for healthcare workers as well as other patients in the hospital. So I think the good news is that the health department has done an amazing job in terms of increasing the availability of testing. And as was said before, commercial labs are really getting online now to increase the availability of testing. So our capacity is markedly increasing. That being said, the issue of PPE is a real one. And so I think it's a balance of, do you want to have somebody in the hospital that's potentially infected that you don't know about or not?
Let's take another call. We've got Kathy from Mount Desert Island, Maine. Kathy, welcome. What's your question?
Thank you. My husband is heading to the Boston airport as we speak to pick up our son, who was having a semester abroad in Denmark. Obviously, that semester abroad was canceled. A friend of mine said they should, especially my son, because he's been traveling for 24 hours from Europe, he should remove his clothes before he comes into the house.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, well, what is that taking it a bit too far?
Carrie Goldberg, has there been any guidance for travelers on anything like that?
I have not heard anything like that. Frankly, what I'm flashing to right now is, I don't know if you read that Norway wrote that it considered the United States to be an underdeveloped healthcare system, and therefore they were cautioning their citizens about the United States. And so I'm actually thinking it might be kind of a good thing to be coming from Denmark, another civilized Scandinavian country, and maybe your son's chances of carrying the virus are actually lower than if he had been here.
And Dr. Hochberg,
Yeah.
Based on what we know about how the virus does or does not exist on surfaces, is that a precaution that would be wise or necessary for the family?
I think the most important is that he's your son. And welcome back to your son. I'm sorry about his missed semester away. But I think the most important really is that he's washing his hands. And if he's, has traveled through an endemic area, that he's potentially sort of isolating himself from you all. And that also depends on who he's staying in the house with. So obviously, we know there's certain people that are going to be at higher risk that we do not want to get exposed. And that's older individuals, people with underlying medical problems like diabetes or heart disease or any other immunocompromising condition. And we really don't want those people to get exposed.
And Dr. Hochberg, are you saying that he should isolate himself from the rest of the family in the house? And if so, for how long?
So if he's come from a setting where there are cases, but that's really only from sort of those level three high-risk countries, then it is recommended that he sort of isolate himself from other people. If he's not coming from one of the higher risk countries, then he just needs to monitor and sort of make sure he doesn't develop symptoms.
Okay, let's try to grab a couple more calls. The lines are quite full. Sean's on the line from Dorchester. Sean, go ahead.
Hi, yes, I'm calling from Dorchester, and I'm asking about my mom who's traveling. She's a senior, 72 years old, and she's in Alabama. My question is, should we have her return back to Boston quickly, or should she stay as long as she's been, as long as she had originally planned?
Great question. Dr. Hochberg.
So I think it depends on what resources she has in Alabama. If she's got somebody that she can stay with there safely for the time being, I think that would be a better option. I'm really cautioning older travelers and people with underlying medical conditions from traveling right now. I think it's puts you at higher risk of getting exposed. So that sort of depends a little bit on your personal situation, though.
And Dr. Hochberg, to add to that, we had a listener write in earlier today and say, what about people who have older adult parents who have spent their winters in Florida? Should they be staying in Florida or should they be coming back?
I would have them stay where they are. I think if you're an older adult, we don't want you getting exposed right now. And so your best bet is going to be to stay where you are and to really try to eliminate contact with other people that could expose you.
Okay, let's try to grab at least one more call. We've got Barbara on the line from Needham. Barbara, go ahead.
Hi there. I am a retired nurse practitioner. My concern is I'm 81 years old, and I've gotten news that supermarkets will open at 6 a.m. to allow senior citizens to shop only if they're over 60. And I think that's a misguided effort.
Why do you think that's misguided?
Well, number one, of course, there'll be probably many other seniors, and we don't know who's a carrier.
I see.
There'll be young people working in the store. And of course, you did answer some of this about...
I get you now, though, Barbara, and I'm sorry. We're tight on time, and I want to make sure to get an answer for you. Carrie Goldberg, have you heard conversations about that? I know you're part of a team of people who have been reporting on all kinds of local responses to the virus.
Yes, we have. I mean, basically, we've just seen senior, elders trying to isolate themselves from others as much as possible. But we have not gotten a sort of all seniors should stay home kind of a directive. I'm curious what Dr. Hochberg thinks.
My suggestion is you really want to eliminate your contact with other people. I think it's a higher risk group, and we know there's more potential problems in that group. And so, I would urge older adults to stay home. I think the same thing with people with underlying medical problems. And to be frank, at this point, we're really entering a phase where the less people come in contact with each other, the less potential there is for exposure, and the less overwhelmed our hospitals are going to get.
So we are not going to get to all of the calls today. Callers, as you know, we've been doing this daily call, and we will continue to do it. I'm sorry if we didn't get to your call today. We will do this again tomorrow. I do want to paraphrase one last call asking whether or not it is safe to swim in a chlorinated pool.
So that should be safe to swim in a chlorinated pool as long as you know that they're actually sort of chlorinating effectively and that you're not coming into contact with surfaces at the pool area that they're potentially not clean. Again, we just want to limit exposure to potential surfaces that might have the virus.
That's Dr. Natasha Hochberg, Associate Professor of Medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Sorry, Carrie, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here today. Radio Boston's Chris Siderick is here with me in the studio right now. Hey there, Chris.
This is usually a lot happier segment, but all right. Let's go. Let's do it.
I know.
Rip the Band-Aid off.
Usually when we check the score, we're a little goofier. Yeah. And I do want to acknowledge for our listeners, we're going to shift gears here. The coronavirus is important. It's really important. And it's almost so much so that it's hard to make room for other things. But we want to acknowledge that there are other things happening in our community that people think about, they react to. And so today we're going to invite you to pull up a chair and join Chris and me in a conversation about a big one.
Yeah, unless you've been living under a rock, you know Tom Brady's future has been in question. More and more people think he's leaving. It's now official. He posted this morning on social media, quote, "I don't know what my football future holds, but it's time for me to open a new stage for my life and career," end quote. Essentially, he will no longer be with the Patriots.
So we want to end the show today kind of thinking through that with you. Does it matter to you right now? Is this a moment when that's important? What happened? Where do we go from here? What's on your mind?
Yeah, and I'm also interested if people are taking this news differently than, say, the Mookie Betts trade and kind of how they're processing all these things and the fact that there is no real sports to look forward to right now. Is that something people are missing? Folks know the number, 1-800-423-8255.
So we're going to start by getting clear on what's happened and what the news is basically as of this minute. So joining us now with the details is Boston Globe national NFL reporter Ben Volen. Ben, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's been a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me today.
So, Ben, what do we know right now?
Well, Tom Brady's gone. That's what we know, that Tom Brady is done with the New England Patriots after 20 seasons. And we all knew this was a possibility, but it's still shocking to see the finality of it today. And to my prediction the whole time was that Brady and Robert Kraft and the Patriots would come together at the last minute and kind of seal the deal and make sure he ends his career as a Patriot. And Robert Kraft told the Globe earlier today that he invited Brady over to his house last night, and he thought that's what was going to happen, that he was going to seal the deal with Brady. And instead, Brady broke the news that it was ending, that he was going to end up, leave the Patriots and continue on with his football journey elsewhere. And Robert Kraft was pretty surprised, but probably not totally surprised.
Yeah, Ben, I want to jump in here. I want to ask you, to me, this kind of feels like one of those rare mutual breakups where both sides were both kind of in the same place where, okay, we've had a great run, but it's time to go our separate ways. Does that line up with kind of what you're hearing?
Well, I think it was mutual in the sense that I don't know how much the Patriots really wanted to commit to Tom Brady, and I don't know if Tom Brady wanted to commit to the Patriots if that's all they were offering him. But if the Patriots wanted to give him a more lucrative contract and guarantee him 2 years, I think he gladly would have come back. I think this was a case of Brady not feeling appreciated the last few years, and that really hit home this time, that the Patriots just weren't going to give him what he's looking for, and other teams will.
So speaking of the other teams there, I just checked Twitter right before I walked into the studio, and I guess Colin Cowherd has said that sources are telling him Brady will be signing with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers tomorrow. Are you hearing any word about any pending deal?
I'm not hearing anything officially, but certainly that is the buzz that Brady is going to be ending up in Tampa Bay. To me, that they've been a dark horse this whole time, and they haven't even been much of a dark horse for the last few weeks. They've been pretty open and honest about the fact that they would be interested in Tom Brady. And this is a franchise that doesn't have a whole lot to lose. They haven't made the playoffs in 12 years. They don't really have a quarterback. Tom Brady would bring a lot of buzz. They've had issues selling tickets the last several years, and they've got a lot of salary cap money and some good players, and frankly look like they need a quarterback to be a pretty competitive team. So I'm not surprised that Brady would pick the Buccaneers over the Chargers. you know, one other thing to consider is that the Buccaneers really operate on the other end of the NFL universe from the Patriots, and they're not on the Patriots schedule next year. So Brady could go to Tampa and not have to worry about the awkwardness of playing the Patriots, whereas, you know, the LA Chargers, they play the Patriots in LA next year, and the Miami Dolphins, they would play the Patriots twice, once down there and once here at Gillette Stadium. Just, I don't think Brady wants anything to do with that, and he can go to Tampa and just kind of move on to the next chapter and leave New England behind and not have to worry about playing them. So I wouldn't be surprised if the announcement comes tomorrow, the first day of free agency. Whoever does sign Brady, they're not going to want to wait around too long. They want to get their quarterback and move on pretty quickly. So Ben, I would expect an announcement soon.
Ben, we're going to move to listener calls in just a minute, and I'm going to ask listeners to answer the same question at 1-800-423-8255 that I'm now going to ask you, which is, what is your best or singular memory of Tom Brady?
Oh, so hard.
It has to be that Super Bowl win against Atlanta.
Yeah.
Just the 28-3 comeback was just, you know, we've never seen anything like that in sports. It's, I think, the greatest comeback ever, certainly in the NFL, maybe in all of sports, to have that comeback and for all the things to go right, and just Brady's spirit and the way he brought him back in the fourth quarter. That was such an iconic night for Tom Brady. So for me, that's when you think of Tom Brady, it's how he's never out of it. And, you know, his captain comeback ability was never more crystallized than it was that night against the Atlanta Falcons.
So Boston Globe National NFL reporter Ben Volen, we'll keep watching the story. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Really appreciate it. It's time to turn to your calls, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
Yeah, we're going to kick it off with Shay in Quincy. Shay, what's on your mind? What are you thinking?
Yeah, so I guess one of my favorite kinds of memories from Tom Brady is whenever he ran, like whenever he would run with the ball, it took like watching another team play to see like, oh, their quarterbacks actually run farther. But we'll miss him. We love him. He was underpaid. He had to do what he had to do.
He had that slow motion look. I'll never forget the juke that took about 3 days against Brian Urlacher in the middle of the field. He definitely was unique when it came to the scrambling.
Thanks for that call, Shay. Chris, I do want to ask you, how are you feeling about this? I mean, you and I have been looking at this, talking about this for months now.
So I mentioned Mookie at the beginning of the segment just because I think there's an interesting contrast here. With the Mookie Betts trade, there was a level of anger to that because it felt like a choice management was making that was not in the best interest of the team. This is an incredible thing coming to an end. And all good things have to come to an end, right? And so we've known for the past 2, 3, 4 years, eventually, Brady will not be playing for this team anymore. They will have to move on. So I find this is a sad moment as opposed to an angry one.
But there's a really big difference between he doesn't play for the Patriots anymore because
right.
he doesn't play football anymore.
Right.
And Tom Brady doesn't play with the Patriots anymore because he doesn't want to be here anymore.
Yeah, but if you've been following this team, you could see that coming. I mean, this is a relationship. Brady is only the fourth NFL player to play 20 seasons with the same team and is the first quarterback to ever do it. So we're already talking about an unprecedented run. And I think of it as any kind of long-term relationship. You're going to have friction. You're going to not always be on the same page. And eventually it comes time to part ways. And I think that's what we saw play out, basically.
So, listeners, it's a weird day to have this news come out. You know, we're thinking about
like one
something.
More thing on the pile.
That's right. We're thinking about something else. Plus, sports are basically not happening. And yet many looked forward to the NFL season as something that might actually happen in the fall. And now this major disruption for the New England Patriots. How are you thinking about it? How are you feeling about it? Are you happy or sad to see this moment come to an end? What are your big memories? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Right now we've got Megan on the line from Whitman, Massachusetts. Megan, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm happy I haven't heard too many negative comments. And
were you expecting some, Megan?
I was, just based on things I've been hearing, you know, when's he going to give us an answer? And my response was always, people felt like he was leading us along and stuff, in my circle anyway. And, you know, I kept saying the Patriots are part of the equation too. Like, this decision wasn't entirely on him. They could have done I don't know what.
Yeah, I mean, according to all reports, Belichick wanted to trade him a couple of years ago. So this has been kind of coming. And if you saw Brady standing at the podium last year, 8-0, just looked miserable. I mean, Tiziana, we talked about it. He did not look like he was happy. He did not look like he was having fun. It just felt like the magic wasn't there anymore for these two groups.
And Megan, do you think that the Pats could have or should have done more than they did to try to keep Tom Brady? Is this a case where, you know, people with Mookie Betts and the Red Sox were saying this was lack of will by the management? Is that your read of this situation, or do you think this was a mutual parting, as Chris has explained it?
I have a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I always hate to see a player, regardless, and we've seen a lot of it. I mean, here in other cities, leave a team that they've been with for this long. Like, you can't make room for them in the end, and especially since he did the hometown discount and all of that.
So many
for his
times.
Whole career.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I don't see anyone in the pipeline for them in that position. Who knows? But
yeah,
I guess I'd rather have a bad Tom Brady than a bad rookie.
Yeah. So let's pick it up from there, Megan. And I appreciate your call. Chris, you know, it's not just that Tom Brady won't be playing for the Patriots anymore. It's that somebody else will be standing or not standing in Tom Brady's shoes.
Yeah.
What does that mean for this, for the city, for the team? You know, for sports fans,
I've been a fan my whole life, so I remember the 2-14 years. Not a lot of people in these parts do. For a lot of people, Patriots really hit the map after the 2001 Super Bowl win, and so I think it might be jarring for folks to, if they look at the standings and this team is, you know, not in the playoff position, they might not know what to make of that. There is probably going to be a rebuild process. I don't know if they're going to try to bring in a veteran quarterback. A lot of folks have talked about maybe Andy Dalton from the Bengals, who's an older quarterback that's just kind of in that mediocre category. The bottom line is whoever the next guy is not going to be Tom Brady, and that's going to be strike one and two against him as training camp opens.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Eric's on the line from Roxbury. Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say, I mean, Tom Brady provided tons of great memories. I mean, I can't even recount how many Super Bowl parties, and like they mentioned the Atlanta game. But at the same time, let's be honest. I mean, the guy's over 40 years old. He's about to start a whole new system. I mean, it's not really looking too good for him, to say the least. But, I mean, he gave us how many Super Bowls? So
6.
He gave us exactly what we wanted.
Yeah.
9 appearances, 6 wins. Who's counting?
That's right. So Chris, to Eric's point, he gave us a lot.
Yeah.
I do find myself thinking, we have a lot of listeners who maybe don't follow football and are like, seriously, what is the big deal? So maybe we should ask, what is the big deal here?
I think every once in a while, it's kind of that once in a generation thing, a sports figure comes along that transcends the sport and becomes a part of the fabric of the city. And I think Tom Brady is that. The level of greatness, the level of, I mean, the drive to win is unlike anything we've ever seen. And I think it really inspired a lot of people. This is a guy who, for the vast majority of his career, folks said was the first to show up and the last to leave. And when you're the quarterback, you don't necessarily have to be that guy. You can kind of usually get away with slacking a bit here and there. But he was always nose to the grindstone, it really committing to winning. You ask him what his favorite ring is, he'd always say the next one. And I think that's what I will remember about him most, that he bought into what the Patriots tried to do here with this quote-unquote system or the Patriot way, this idea of nobody's bigger than the team, everybody shows up and puts in the work, and the sum of our parts will be greater than however that phrase goes.
So I've kind of got this image in my head.
We've got a lot of emotions here.
Of that sort of the pantheon of New England sports greats, and I'm looking at Bill Russell there, and I'm looking at Ted Williams there, and granted, some of the people in the pantheon are still with us and some aren't.
Yeah.
But does he immediately, now that he's left the New England Patriots, float up into that?
Oh, yeah. He was already there, I think. For me, he rivals Bill Russell as the greatest winner of all time. The records that he set, you're not going to see touched. 17 times in the playoffs, 6 Super Bowl wins, 4 Super Bowl MVPs. I don't think you're going to see anyone come close to that kind of performance. I'd say he's the greatest to ever play the game. And as I said, he rivals Bill Russell for the greatest winner in all of sports.
All right, let's get one more call in. We've got Marco on the line from Arlington. Marco, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just think on top of remembering all the things that Tom Brady did, for this team in the city. We should also remember all the things he didn't do. He never trash-talked opponents. He never trash-talked referees. He never threw anyone under the bus. He never did anything that lacked class. He was a consummate professional. He never didn't try hard. I mean, he was really just as great for the things that he didn't do as an athlete and as a person as for the things that he accomplished. And I think that's what really sets him off. And I'm sorry to see him go, but I wish him the best, and I think he deserves whatever success he can get,
yeah,
no matter where he gets.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's how Pats Nation feels. I don't think there's any sort of ill will towards Tom Brady. I just want to highlight the last part of Bill Belichick's statement because I think it really rings true. Sometimes in life, it takes some time to pass before truly appreciating something or someone, but that has not been the case with Tom. He is a special person and the greatest quarterback of all time. And I think what was so great about the Tom Brady experience here in New England was we all knew as we were watching how incredible what we were watching was. And it's rare that you get to appreciate that in the moment.
All right. In our last 10 seconds, Chris, what are you going to tell your kids about Tom Brady?
He was the greatest.
All right. Chris Riddick, thanks for joining us and kind of mourning this other change in the New England landscape today.
Thanks for having me.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Sitterick, Paris Alston, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director with engineering today by Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're going to keep with our coronavirus coverage. We're going to continue to take your calls. So join us again tomorrow here for more Radio Boston.